Call the Senate Finance meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, January 28th, and with us is Co-Chairman Kelly, Vice Chairman Fairclough, Senator Huffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Olson, I believe, is still trying to get here. Please expect to hear sometime today. And Senator Bishop will be coming.
He's expected to play in time around 7 this evening.
Okay. Oh, so he won't make this meeting. Okay, no problem. Okay, so we do have a quorum to conduct business, although today is just a overview from the Alaska Railroad. This has been a topic that's of much interest to all of the folks here on the Finance Committee, especially the capital budget side of things. And so we're going to get a presentation today on the positive train control, and I believe presenting will be Bill O'Leary, the new president. Congratulations, by the way, Bill. Eileen Riley, who's the vice president of Advanced Train Control Systems and Technology. And I don't know, Wendy, are you going to present? Okay. Well, you're more than welcome to if you'd like. Okay, and we have the lights down here a little bit, not trying to set a new mood or a new finance committee, but I think you have a short video. So I'm going to turn the floor over to the folks from Alaska Railroad, if you want to join us, and the floor is yours.
Super, thank you, Senator, and we very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Again, for the record, my name is Bill O'Leary. I'm the president and CEO of the railroad, and to my right, who will be doing the vast majority of the talking today, is Eileen Riley, our vice president of Advanced Train Control Systems and Technology. And we're here today, as Senator Meyer mentioned, to speak about positive train control, a project very near and dear to our hearts. And Eileen is going to be taking you through some of the nuts and bolts and the details on this project. My role at the beginning here is just to chat very quickly, give you an overview of some of the highlights you're going to hear throughout, especially given this is the Finance Committee, some of the numbers out there. This is especially for the Alaska Railroad, a very big, very expensive project, not only to develop, but also for us to maintain later on. But we're looking at a roughly $153 million project all in. The Alaska Railroad, through its own internal cash and its monies derived from its federal funds, has spent nearly $65 million to date on this. Last year, the legislature appropriated $19.1 million, for which we're very thankful and appreciate that. And we have roughly $70 million to go to meet this unfunded federal mandate. Our request this year is for 2 years' worth of funding, which comes out to just shy of $41 million. And we'll talk a little bit about why we're asking for 2 years here in a few minutes. Governor Parnell's budget that came out in December included a total of $15 million in it. We appreciate that effort, but I'm going to discuss with you today about why we'd like to get that number up, if possible. The implications, if we don't implement this project by the deadline, the federal deadline on this, there's a number of them, but the largest one is the impact to our passenger services, and actually it will cease our passenger services going forward. So significant impact for not only the Alaska Railroad, but also to our partner entities and also the state. So that's really just a very high overview of what you're going to hear in some level of detail here, and I'd like to turn it over to Eileen to take the presentation.
And if I may, before we change speakers, you've already generated some questions, Mr. O'Leary. Senator Fairclough, and then I'll go to Senator Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. O'Leary, can you tell me what percentage of passengers contribute to revenue for the railroad? So what's the percentage of revenue generated from passenger services?
Passenger services, this is the last year, we're in the process of closing out 2013 right now, but roughly $25 million of our revenue is related to passenger services, out of give or take $145 million total revenue for the corporation.
Anything else, Senator Faircloth? Senator Kelly?
I just kind of spaced on what you said the deadline was.
Senator, through the chair, I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that. As it stands right now, the deadline is December 31st of 2015.
Okay, no other questions? And Ms. O'Reilly? I'm sorry, Riley. I can't see with the lights down here, so sorry.
Now, this is the first time I'm testifying, so I don't know if I have to, for the record, state my name.
Maybe. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, please do.
I'm Eileen Riley with the Alaska Railroad. I'm Vice President for Advanced Train Control and Technology, and I've been working on PTC since 1997. So I have been involved for quite some time. And I wanted to start, we can look at, we can talk about this slide, but there's a video from that the Class 1 railroads put together and the commuters that really does a nice job of explaining the nuts and bolts. So I thought we could start there.
Positive Train Control, PTC, is the largest, most complex technical effort ever undertaken by the American rail industry. And getting it right is a challenge that the industry, passenger, freight, and suppliers must meet and will meet. Positive train control is advanced technology designed to automatically stop or slow a train before certain incidents caused by human error can occur. Collisions, derailments, and work zone mishaps. Here's how it works. Through GPS, Wi-Fi, and cryptographically protected radio transmissions, computers and locomotives and rail operations centers across the country are linked. Across the national network, critical information is continuously relayed. Speed limits, train movement authorization, switch positions, location of work zones, and other key operational data. The engineer still controls the train, but PTC acts as a safeguard to prevent speed and train movement violations. The system provides an onboard warning if the train moves within the warning zone of a potential violation. Should the engineer not respond before reaching the braking zone, the PTC system is designed to automatically and always stop or slow the train. But to work properly, PTC requires highly complex computer processing and communications technologies to analyze the vast number of factors that affect multiple and interconnected rail operations. And PTC requires major development, testing, certification, and installation of equipment in a very short time frame, by the end of 2015 as mandated by Congress. Consider these numbers. PTC, for freight rail operators alone, will require new technology along more than 60,000 miles of track, including installation of more than 20,000 cell signaling towers. Over 20,000 locomotives will need to include PTC equipment, and this effort will require the majority of the industry's 180,000 employees to receive specialized training with the new system. Freight railroads have already spent almost $3 billion and expect the price tag to be $8 billion by the time there is full interoperability. A nationwide PTC system built, installed, tested, and approved on this scale simply cannot happen by the 2015 deadline. For PTC to work effectively, it must be interoperable. Passenger, commuter, and freight trains must be able to talk to each other seamlessly across all railroad systems. Any breakdown in interoperability presents unacceptable risks to the safety and efficiency of America's rail network. A reliable nationwide PTC system also requires railroads to have enough radio frequency spectrum to continuously communicate with every PTC-equipped freight and passenger train operating on a PTC-equipped line. In addition to procuring the additional radio spectrum necessary for PTC, the industry has developed and is purchasing and installing new digital radios that are capable of transmitting the vast amounts of data required to keep PTC-equipped lines working safely and reliably. Along with the technical challenges of meeting the 2015 deadline, is the Federal Railroad Administration's complex certification process required before PTC can be turned on and become fully operational. All all aspects of a PTC system, from locomotives to the new wireless communications network to the thousands of signals, switches, and wayside devices, must be certified by the Federal Railroad Administration prior to any use. This certification is mandatory before trains can go into service. America's passenger and freight railroads will install a positive train control system that strengthens an already robust safety system. But getting it right must be the overriding objective. The stakes involved, the safety and the operational integrity of America's nationwide rail system, are too high for anything less.
Thank you for sitting through that.
Yeah, actually, that was very, very interesting. Thank you for that.
So and, the first thing.
Well, before we go too far, I just want to say, too, I understand that this can be very technical. So, and we're, for the most part, not a real technical group. Okay. So don't get us too far in the weeds, okay?
That's the plan.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
One of the questions when you watch that video is, why would the Alaska Railroad have to be interoperable with the freight railroads and the commuters and passengers? That came to mind when I watched that video, so I'll answer that if you don't mind. The equipment, Alaska Railroad's been trying to do this since 1997. We were moving along pretty well. Had some successes, ran a lot of trains, stopped a lot of trains. And then when the mandate, and we'll get to that, that for this positive train control system was put in place, the Class 1 railroads, there's seven of them, big billion-dollar corporations, went out and bought all the frequencies for the spectrum. They bought the radio company. They negotiated with all the suppliers so that they get first dibs on equipment. If we're not interoperable on the equipment side, we can't buy anything, and we can't afford to go it alone. I think they talked a lot about the research and development of this project, and we learned very quickly when the rule was passed just how expensive continuing on our own path would be. We got a rough order of magnitude change order from our vendor at that time that doubled our costs, actually tripled our costs. So that's why we're interoperable, putting in an interoperable system so we can get equipment. So I don't know if that brings up any questions. On how PTC works, I can go over a little bit more details, or was the video enough to give you an idea on PTC?
Senator Kelly.
Could you just talk a little bit about the level of lean in Alaska? Excuse me.
I knew you were coming, but I didn't beat you. Could you just talk a little bit about the level of need in Alaska, given that I think that video, you know, as you look at the high density of rail traffic in communities and where there are moving cars and those kinds of things, I would say, gosh, we need something like this. But when you have one train and...
On our busiest days in the summer, we can have 22 trains out on the track with all of the passenger services, freight trains, work trains. So we are as dense as most railroads are in the lower 48 from about May 15th to September 15th. And then because of our access, there's not much road access, which the lower 48 gets to experience. We have a lot of maintenance away people working on the rail. And unfortunately, because of weather, all of our maintenance away, heavy gang work, keeping us in a state of good repair, working bridges, ties, taking care of the rail, happened during that summertime. And as a matter of fact, the human errors that they're trying to aren't just train-to-train collisions or trains going too fast. They're trying to protect those maintenance way workers. And in October 2013, It was the highest level of deaths, fatalities for maintenance way workers being hit by trains ever in the rail industry. So we not only need to protect with this system trains, we need to protect our maintenance way workers that are out on the track.
Do you have a number, Bill, of the accidents that have happened in the history of the Alaska Railroad where trains killed or did great damage to other trains or buses or car, whatever? Do you have a number like that?
In 19...
Oh, you have that number? I just asked Bill because of his history with the railroad.
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, we, in 1976, had a rear-end collision, killed an employee. In 1995, when we got two trains stopped, we had a train, human factor error, that went 30 miles past its authority, kept reporting, two people on the train reporting their location. Thank goodness the other train heard their report on a station and said that is not the right milepost, stopped their train and told the dispatcher, I'm ready to back up. Everything got stopped 90 seconds from impact. That was in 1995. Just this year, we have had three overspeed incidents that we are lucky that we did not derail a train that were close. And I'll show you some derailments that happened from overspeed. The one that you probably remember is in the Bronx this year. I'll show it to you in a little bit. But we have had our share just in the last 9 months of human factor errors that so say we need this overlay.
In 1976 was the only accident. I know there's been more.
That we had a fatality.
Yeah.
But we certainly have had derailments that we have spilled that would have been keeping track of the switches and would have been PTC preventable.
Thank you.
As a matter of fact, we've had two of those that we could have prevented.
Senator Dunleavy, did you have a question?
Lots.
Go ahead. So you're going to walk us through this PowerPoint, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to take questions as we go or at the end, or what's your preference?
Whichever you're comfortable with.
Okay. Senator Dunleavy, go ahead.
So you are advocating for this new control device? Or are you, I'm wondering, just trying to find out where you are at, the railroad is at. Do you think, is this something you would have come to us for if it was not a federal mandate?
We were able to fund the project, and I was going to get to that. When we were, before the rule changed in 2008, there was a big accident, Chatsworth, California, killed 25 people. Trainman was texting and got past a signal. In 7 days, a law was passed called the Rail Safety Improvement Act in 2008, and the dilemma for us is we have 168 switches that let us get one train or maintenance away out of, because we're a one-line railroad. When that law passed, now we had to equip each of those switches with monitoring equipment, which we hadn't expected to do.
It's okay, but...
And that cost us extra... close to $60 million. So we were expecting that we could fund this project with our own funds until the Rail Safety Improvement Act added that new rule into it and forced the system to be interoperable, which changed the technology that we had to use.
Okay. Well, just with due respect, that was an answer to not the question, though. Would you have taken on this new system regardless if it was a mandate or not?
We did.
Okay.
We started in 1997 after our near miss in Montana Creek.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Kelly?
The Rail Safety Act that was enacted, the provision in that accelerated everything was just a time that you were on the path to developing something like this or buying into a national system since the accident in 70, whatever it was, 76.
Mm-hmm.
So that they pass a law, and all that's happened that's put us in this position of where we got to fund something in big chunks. It's just a time frame?
Yes.
Okay.
The date is December 31st, 2015. We're not going to make that date.
No, I understand. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure that there was not some other thing that I wasn't aware of. It's just a change in time frame, and all of a sudden we've got a bunch of money we got to spend. That's fine.
Okay. You know, I think, well, first of all, Senator Bishop is online with us in Fairbanks, so thank you for joining us, Senator Bishop. And then I'm going to go to Senator Fairclough. But then I think you should probably just go ahead and go through your PowerPoint, because we're generating some questions you're going to address anyway in the PowerPoint. Senator Fairclough?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many cell towers will we be constructing along the route?
Through the chair, the Alaska Railroad is not using cell as our communication from the wayside. Only one railroad is doing that. It's probably a misnomer. It should have said communication towers. But we are having to add 5 tower locations. We already are. We'll have 33 towers when we're done. We already had a lot of towers in place for our voice communication system. And we are in a joint venture with the state of Alaska on these towers, these base station towers.
Mr. Chairman, what I was thinking about there is that the NSA breach and then requiring inside of a piece of legislation all this new communication that should, I just wonder whether it's interoperable with communications for individuals versus contained in a singular system. And if it's interoperable and it provides additional benefit to the people of America, then that's one thing, but is that another software or hardware point where people can extract information without the consumer knowing? That's what I was thinking about. Thank you.
Okay. Would you like to continue?
So PTC became a most wanted on the National Transportation Safety Board in the 1990 timeframe. Because of all the human factor errors that were taking place, there was a head-on collision in the 70s in Penn Central. There were rear-end accidents in 1986. So in 1990, the National Transportation Safety Board said there's got to be a way to prevent these human factor errors. You can see the disastrous effects of a train going through a switch that was aligned in the wrong position. A conductor reported it to be normal, and it was in the reverse position that took the train right at 40 miles an hour into a chlorine tank. That was in Graniteville. At that point, there was a big push. There was a rulemaking. They called it Subpart H, 236 Subpart H, to put in PTC, but it was unfunded. Then we had the Metrolink accident where 25 people were killed while somebody was texting. And within 7 days, the Rail Safety Improvement Act was enacted. That accident met the $200 million cap on damages. And it was very significant. So the Rail Safety Improvement Act was a law. The reason that the Alaska Railroad has to comply with it is the second line that's highlighted. Each entity providing regularly scheduled intercity or commuter rail passenger transportation. We are considered regularly scheduled passenger services. So for the Alaska Railroad, we have large numbers of passengers per train moving through curvy, remote territory. We have done a lot of work with the Federal Railroad Administration, looking for potentials, ways to reduce the cost, not do the system. Right now we're working on limiting the number of switches we have to equip, but the concern is how large are passenger trains, how many people are on them if we were to have an event. Okay, so 2010, they finally finished the regulations based on the 2008 law. There were some major changes from the 2007 voluntary rules. Number four, train movements through a mainline switch in the improper position was added, which increased our costs dramatically. And the picture shows you a little bit of why it's so important. We have a freight train meeting a passenger train. See how close they are? Freight trains can take up to 2 miles to stop. So if they misjudge the meet location while the passenger is waiting to move into the siding, you can have a head-on collision. So that was why number four was added. Three, incursions into established work zone limits was now strengthened. And now the regulations, we're going through a new notice of proposed rulemaking after the October 2013 fatalities on how do we make sure we keep those trained and work people that work on the track away from each other. Train-to-train collisions by enforcing authority limits and overspeed derailments are the two main tenets that we have always tried to equip this system with. They've added the words reliably and functionally to the definition. If the system isn't running, you can still run your trains, but you're at risk. So the rule requires that you prove that this system is going to be reliable. Okay. So unfortunately, while everybody is trying to extend the deadline, there have been a number of serious accidents in the rail industry. They started in 2010, and these are accidents that include trains, fatalities, and 2013, a train took a curve in Bronx, New York, Metro North, and at 88 miles on a 30-mile-an-hour curve, and it derailed the train. And at this point, the National Transportation Safety Board it started in 2012, but 2014, again, made this the most wanted safety project for the rail industry. Okay.
Senator Kelly.
Are most of the problems the error of the driver, something like nodding off or texting like that?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, yes.
Operator, what do you call it, operator?
They call them human factor errors.
What do they call
it? Human factor errors. Okay. Those are the majority.
So when a train is being operated, is there one person in the cab or two?
For our Alaska Railroad, two, okay. Unless we're at a meet and someone has to go on the ground to open a switch, but we operate with two. A lot of the commuter railroads will operate with one person in the cab.
Is it the job of the one person to watch the other one for getting sleepy or not observing protocols?
Through the chair, Senator Kelly, that is their job, but we have had our share of incidents with both the conductor and the engineer reporting wrong locations, not getting the train slowed down, saying it's time to get the train slowing. So, yes, you would think that two people in the cab would eliminate those human factor errors, but it has not been the case with the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five accidents in the freight railroads with two people in the cab did not eliminate those errors. Okay.
Thanks.
Senator Burkloff has a question.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, it begs the question, can the conductor or engineer override the system?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, the system is being designed that they cannot override the system. If they try to cut out the system, the dispatch center will know, and the first thing that happens when they cut the system out is a penalty break is applied, and it is not released until an officer gets there. And
this is my concern for Alaska, avalanches and earthquakes. If you're on a single rail track and you're in the mountains and we have an avalanche come down that's going to kick off a positive, and maybe there's not switches there, so that isn't a danger for us during those, but if an engineer or conductor can't override and they have to wait for something, in Alaska at least, people could be dying. There are people on the train trying to prevent an emergency or running from an avalanche where they're trying to accelerate out. I don't know if those things have happened in Alaska.
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, the system is designed, we give an authority, and as long as they are in that authority, they can still back up to get away from that avalanche, or they can go forward. We have slide zones, close to 50 of them, and when they're on, when we suspect that there's some danger, the trains have a way that they need to operate through them. They stop, they look, and then they proceed at a slower speed. But we don't prohibit them from either moving forward. We give them enough authority to get out of there, and we let them also back up. So we handle those slag zones in this system the way we operate today to try and protect against them.
Mr. Chairman, my new car has a beeper on it, so it tells you if you go over the white line, and it makes all kinds of noise. And I've left it on purpose just so, I'm driving the best way that I can. And unfortunately, it has a positive control act where it will break. And in snow and ice conditions, it starts to break when it sees the white line. Right. And in Alaska, that can put you in a tailspin. And so I haven't taken the time to notify the manufacturer yet, but multiple times this winter already, when I'm just riding on a regular road in my lane, if there's a break between the ice and the black of the asphalt, my car will start to break. Wow. And
of course, we know anti-lock brakes on ice are actually lock brakes.
My car actually does it very gently, so it hasn't actually thrown me yet, but because I can feel it happening, I can correct. But that's why I'm interested in accidents, because I'm afraid my car is going to throw me into one.
So what kind of car do you have? We'll make sure to avoid that.
No, I don't think that's fair to the manufacturer. I love my car.
We rent a lot of cars. I don't want to get your car.
Anyway, go into remove the fuse.
Yeah.
That's the best way to do it.
Okay. Sorry, we diverted here a little bit. Go ahead and continue with your presentation.
So items that PTC does not address. So PTC is designed to protect against those human factor errors. However, if we don't keep our system in a state of good repair, including our equipment, we can have broken wheels, pulled drawer bars, seized bearings in our journals. As Senator Faircloth mentioned, there's washouts and rock slides and broken rail, and if rail gets too hot, it can kink. And we have a lot of grade crossing events, I hate to call them accidents, and we've had some vandalism. Now, we do a lot of patrols to protect against these, but the best way to do it is keep your railroad, at least for the first two conditions, in a state of good repair. Railroads are capital intense. We should spend between $40 and $50 million a year just to keep our bridges, 169 bridges and 600 miles of rail, in good shape. including the ties that hold them. You know, part of making it through a curve too fast is having your ties in good shape so they can take that extra stress, right? So PTC is not going to eliminate all events. It's important to keep our railroad in a state of good repair to have the capital to continue. Now, since we've gotten the federal funds, our track geometry where the rail spread or the rail rolled have significantly reduced. As a matter of fact, we have, I can't think of any that we've had, so we're in a lot better shape with the infusion of federal dollars, but we need to continue. We only took care of 25% of our 1950 ties, and ties usually are a 35-year life. And ties are what hold this railroad together, right? So, okay, so what if the Alaska Railroad does not comply? I think this was a question earlier. The federal law provides penalties for noncompliance. FRA can fine us with 61 different PTC-related violations, and I brought the regulations just to give you an example of what they are, if anyone's interested. Maximum FRA fine is $16,000 per day per violation, so that's every train per day until we get in compliance. And if they determine it's willful, it's $25,000 per day. And FRA, this pertains to the persons, so this is not just the railroad getting fined. Individuals that are responsible for the railroad are on the hook. And as a matter of fact, we've had folks have violations where the FRA has fined the individual, so they are not shy about fining the individual as well as the corporation. And their last hammer is prohibiting passenger service, okay?
And so this next, the next two slides are exploring that a little bit. So what if passenger service on the Alaska Railroad was eliminated? And we have a relatively clear understanding for the Alaska Railroad Corporation what that would do to us, both financially and from a operating perspective and with our employees. But we were less clear about what impact it would have to some of our customers, some of the entities we partner with, and generally to the state of Alaska. So we, late last year, contracted with the McDowell Group, an economic research firm, which I'm sure has presented to this body before, to help us determine some of these impacts. And we're in the process of basically running spell check on that report right now. It's ready to be issued. But kind of a sneak preview here on these next two slides. And this first slide is really just identifies the people and the jobs that are associated with the passenger service for the railroad. And of course, first and foremost is Alaska, at least in our mind, Alaska Railroad positions. But then there are also positions related to the our partners, the cruise entities, and others out there who work with us. And then there is just the impact of the passengers themselves on and their spending, and how many jobs those support in the state's economy here. So kind of cutting to the chase on this, we're looking at nearly 2,000 jobs, about 1,970 jobs using 2012 data. And you see that's on those three bar graphs on the left side. On the right side then is the economic the multiplier effect of what those jobs contribute to the economy, or how much those jobs are worth. So looking at approximately $50 million, according to the work McDowell has done. So I'm not going to read this eye chart of a page here, but the bottom line on it is the railroad jobs would certainly go away, not an insignificant number of them. There would certainly be significant impact to the other entities, whether it's the Holland America Princess, whether it's one of the 275 businesses that do provide goods and services to the railroad for its passenger operations.
But there's a couple of other kind of key pieces to this that, you know, trying not to sound like we're overly self-promoting, but the railroad is a big deal for the visitors coming to Alaska. There are very few places in the United States where, you know, rail is as important for the visitor experience. And that's going to be, you know, that's kind of intangible, a little more difficult to quantify. But one of the things we could quantify is in that final bullet down there, that if the same number of passengers were to come, may not be the case, but to move that many passengers, you'd be looking at, you know, a little shy of 4,000 additional motor coach trips on the Parks and the Seward Highway currently served by the railroad, which is going to have pretty significant implications not only for the, you know, the operators of those coaches, but also for congestion issues, safety issues, and maintenance impacts on the road system itself. So, again, I think the takeaway from these two slides are, you know, the loss of passenger services from Alaska Railroad, loss of Alaska Railroad passenger services would be a big deal.
When we watched the video, we saw lots of numbers from the lower 48 railroads, so I thought I'd kind of put it in perspective for us. We have over 600 miles of track, but 525 miles need to be PTC. In our terminal areas, we would not put in PTC. We have 54 locomotives and cab cars that need to be equipped to support PTC. We have two methods that we operate. One, where we have a train go to the next signal. If it's a yellow or a green, they run at the correct speed. Those would have to be monitored to ensure that the train is running. If they had a stop, for sure they stop. We have 108 switches that have to be monitored. On the right, you see an example of one of the bungalows we need to put in to monitor our switches. Commercial power is not readily available on a good part of the railroad, so we need to generate our own power. So you see wind generators, you see solar panels, and then we have the ability to plug in portable generators when we're not getting either enough wind or power. So 108 switches to be monitored. We have a limited operations exception, exemption, you can call it what you want, to eliminate, and they're not shown here, 42 switches where we're really light traffic on our railroad, not to monitor those switches. That would be an extra $14.7 million if we don't get that exception. I don't know if any questions?
Yeah, actually, I do.
Sure.
So, how is this working in other states? I mean, we're probably, you know, financially better off than most states in the lower 48, and so I'm wondering, in other states, are they having to use public funds to do this, or are the railroads, you know, there's multiple railroads in lower 48, are they able to pay for it, or are they getting federal funds? How do we compare?
I have a slide. Can we go to that?
Well, if you're getting to that, I'll just wait.
I do have a slide.
Okay, perfect.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So here are the two ways we meet. We have the top where we are looking for signals, and on the bottom, we're counting on the operator to get stopped before they get to the meet location. So that's called track warrant. The train operator still operates their train as they would. The only time that this system, it's a safety overlay, comes into is when that warning curve, if they're not listening to it, they're getting warned that you need to stop. If they don't get stopped, then a penalty brake comes on and they're stopped and the message comes back to the office. Okay. I don't know if you want to go through the whole origins of PTC, but we did start in 1997. The Alaska Railroad was very far behind the times. They did not even have a what we call a computer-aided dispatch system that was used throughout all of the lower 48 railroads. We did everything on a big piece of paper. So the first thing we had to do was put in a computer-aided dispatch system in 1999 to at least make sure that the dispatchers did not overlap any trains. Our communication system was based on 1960 technologies, big vacuum tubes failing all the time, so we weren't getting messages. So we had to upgrade our communication system, and that is when we created a shared use agreement with the state of Alaska. So we are on the first responder network. We pay a lot of capital costs, and the maintenance is taken care of by the state of Alaska. So we're trying to do things efficiently on the communication side. There was a test that was done after some accidents funded by the FRA, UP, which is the largest railroad, and the BNSF, the second largest railroad from Oregon to Washington. It proved the system would work, but the costs were too high to make it commercially available unless it was mandated. In 1995, we had our near miss, and our vice president of transportation said, find a way to protect our trains. So we began work with GE Harris, and the radio systems weren't sophisticated enough to deal with. So we ended our contract, got some money returned, and moved on to a company, US&S. And we were moving along, probably not as easily as we'd like, but it was, we had gone out 99 test braking to make sure that the braking would not come on at the wrong time, and if we had ice on the rail, what would happen? Leaves on the rail. But when the Rail Safety Improvement Act came along, it changed the whole complexion. The Class I railroads bought the radio companies, they bought the spectrum, and we were pretty much forced to negotiate a contract with a company called Wabtec Railway Electronics. We have done a lot of work in our radio side to get ready, because this is a communication-based train control. If you can't communicate, you're not going to be able to protect your train. So we've been doing a lot of work since 2010 on the communication side of the network. And in 2014, January 16th, we cut over to a new computer-aided dispatch system that is PTC ready.
You know, if I may just interrupt, just to help me out, when did we acquire the railroad from the federal government? What year was that?
Senator, that was 1985.
1985. Okay. Thank you.
I'm not sure if you want to go into the details of the PTC implementation status, but we are getting ready to equip all the locomotives. We are putting in lots of servers. We have high rail equipment that looks like locomotives, so we can get out there and test. One of the biggest challenges to figure out location, you cannot rely on GPS alone. When your rail at a siding and a main are 14 and a half feet apart, you have to have only 95% of the time will GPS be able to accurately identify your location. So we have to go out there and get to 7.5 feet precision on every place that we need to stop, and use that data and keep tracking against it. So we're always correcting using GPS, and we use the tachometer and switch position to figure out where we're at. So we use, I don't know if people have heard the name Common Filter. We take lots of sources of data to keep checking our position. And this system is developed to be what they call fail-safe. It's, and you have to be 99.999%. You have to be able to prove that it's that safe that you will not have an accident. And fail-safe means stop the train. If all else fails, if you get confused about location or something happens, we'll stop the train, except we have exceptions in avalanche areas. But we're warning folks where they're at. Okay. So this slide is an eye chart. Wasn't trying to actually have you read that, but you will see in the press that the Alaska Railroad is moving along pretty quickly and might be one of the first railroads to come live. Well, one thing is we don't have to have the interoperability issues, so we can move relatively quickly, but we're not going to make the December 31st deadline. We'll be sometime in 2016, but we will not be, we cannot afford to have all our switches taken care of. So we will have certification and we'll be running what they call revenue demonstration until we can get into full compliance. FRA's point of view is if you can show good faith effort of moving this project forward, they're not going to start penalizing you for not making the December 31st, 2015. But they expect good faith effort. And we report now every half year how much is implemented, how much is installed, and we get regular visits to make sure we are progressing this system. And every time we do a test with a train, the FRA is on board, so they're well aware of our progress and our good faith attempt. So we are not in compliance, and the FRA will not give us full certification until all of the wayside equipment, which is switches and signals, are installed. Okay. So the PTC deadline extension status, you want to take this? There have been lots of bills and lots of support from all of the rail industry to extend the deadline, from the American Association of Railroads, which is most of all of the Class 1 railroads and some of the short lines and passenger railroads, from the American Public Transportation Authority. Those folks are really having a problem, commuter, and we'll get to that in a second, because of funding. Short line railroads are not required to put in PTC except if they run on a Class 1 railroad, and they're very far behind the schedule. So at this point, it says most railroads. Probably no railroads will make the 2015 deadline. Lots of support to extending the deadline to 2018, including the Federal Railroad Administration. But there haven't been any support to get the legislation passed to do that. The railroad is making a good faith effort to implement PTC, so we don't have the FRA fine us or do any other bad things that they could do. Okay, so this is...
I'm going to jump in here for a minute here. This is kind of getting to the financing end of the project here. And this pie chart really does sort of tell the story of where we've been and where we need to go with this. On the light blue pie, that's the 42%, $63.8 million there. That is the amount to date that the Alaska Railroad, either through cash generated from its freight, passenger, and real estate activities, has put in, or that we have used some of the different sources of federal monies that were available to us at the time and put in through 2013. So, and a vast majority of that has been spent. As I mentioned earlier, legislature appropriated and the governor approved the in 2014 $19.1 million to keep the project moving forward. So that leaves us then with approximately $70 million left to fund this $153 million project. So the ask this year, the request this year, is in the light green, the 2015 state budget request, $40.8 million, which accounts for 2 years actually worth of project funding. And while Eileen can go into more of the details if you're so interested, the reason for the 2 years is just purely from an efficiency perspective. It's living year by year on a project of this type, it becomes more difficult for effectively the procurement side of the house and making sure that we have the supplies, we have the authority, and therefore the funding in place to be able to purchase the longer lead time items, get those ordered so they're going to be here in time to meet our deadlines. If assuming and we receive this 40.8 funding, that would leave then $29 million in the 2017-2018 time frame. Now, a very important, it's kind of in this fine print down at the bottom there, but where it says the graph does not include $5 to $6 million.
of ongoing O&M cost. And this is the care and feeding of this system, which is going to be required after it's fully implemented in the 2018 timeframe. At this point, the Alaska Railroad is planning on funding that. You know, it's going to be a significant impact to us, but it's something that we're looking to do. So if I had to put this in sort of a continuum here, you're looking at, you know, the railroad put in, through its monies and its federal monies available to it, the first $64 million. At the end of the day, we're going to be responsible for, again, I call it the care and feeding, but the operations and maintenance of this system after implementation. Where we need the state and the legislature and the governor's assistance is for that middle section to complete the project. You know, answering some of the questions, or harking back to one of the questions that was posed earlier, would we have done this but for the Rail Safety Improvement Act? The answer is yes. We certainly started this project back in the 1997 timeframe. And our intent was to use the funding available to us, either internally generated or from the federal sources, to continue to pay for this. That has changed, kind of the confluence of factors come together, which has made that impossible. The commercial activity drop on the railroad has severely impacted our ability to generate cash to put towards this project, while at the same time, you have the we took a significant cut in our federal money from the Federal Transit Administration through the in the last federal transportation reauthorization. And then kind of completing the unholy trinity of this thing was the concept of the deadline being put on us, you know, a firm deadline of 2015, which, again, we've already discussed is going to be problematic to make. But that's kind of the state of play here and why we're coming to you, why we came to you last year, why we're coming to you this year.
Okay, so my original question was, how does this compare with other states?
And slide 25 is going to get there for
okay,
you, Senator.
Senator Kelly has a question.
When would you have anticipated that you...
When would you have anticipated that you would have this system in place had the deadline not been imposed? Given financial difficulties, all that, if back of the napkin, just kind of a rough date.
Not sure. I mean, things changed when
When RSIA came into play, it did change, Senator, the game pretty much as to what was required. It was, I don't know if we can give you a really good answer on that. I mean, it would have been, I think, by the, 2018-2020 time frame would be my guess on that, but that's all.
So a 2018 extension that many other states are asking for would really help. It would put you somewhere near what you anticipated you would the state could have afforded.
Given the original scope prior to what the Rail Safety Improvement Act of 2008 layered on top of us.
Okay.
Different project now, really.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So this next graph is just, again, kind of slicing it a little bit different way, and we felt remiss coming to the Finance Committee without having at least one Excel chart in here. So it this shows in the yellow, basically the different segments of the project, where those monies have been spent and from what source for the monies that are available to us now. Again, the $63.8 million. As 94% of that has gone out the door, 100% of that has been committed or is under contract. I mean, using some of the state parlance, encumbered. On the state the state funds we received last year, $19 million. Again, those monies were available to us July 1st of last year, and we have 72% of those under contract at this point, and are spending as we move along through that. And bringing us to sort of the final slide, breaking out that nearly $70 million of additional need, broken out by year and by the different type or different objects of expenditure for the project. Again, sort of split into the back office and locomotive, and then the wayside.
So if you combine the 2015 and 2016 numbers, you get that $40.8 million, which is our request at this point. And it took us a while, but we got to slide 25 finally. So I'm going to turn that back to Eileen.
Thanks, Chairman Meyer, for giving us so much time to get here. These are four commuter rail examples of how they're funding their project. Metrolink, at the top, has received $211 million from state and local sources, and they've redirected some of their federal funds. They've gotten federal funds through the California DOT high-speed rail. Now, they just canceled their contract with one vendor, their integrator, and are in the process of renegotiating with our vendor, which is good and bad because we won't have as much resources. But they will not make the date now, and they were the folks that said they would make the date, and that budget will certainly go over now. So Metrolink is our first example. Caltrain is using federal funds from the high-speed rail program funds that came out in the MAP 21, but they are building high-speed rail. And in order to run that high-speed rail, they have to have PTC, where our rail was already in place, so we could not apply for that, and we did not qualify as high-speed rail. Denver RTD is using 50% of what they call a full funding grant. Again, they are building their rail, so they were able to receive an FTA grant, and 50% is state and local funds. In order to run, though, that new rail, they have to put PTC in. Trinity Rail Express, the North Central Texas Council on Government gave them a little bit money to get RFPs out on the street. Rest to be identified, and there is major pressure on those folks to get going if they want to continue passenger service. All the way, this has made it all the way up to the head of the Department of Transportation when Mr. LaHood, Commissioner LaHood, was in place.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Huff.
What percentage of the passenger transportation system on rail is private, and what percentage is, like Alaska, government operated?
There is no private.
There's no private
passenger rail. I did not mention Amtrak, which is probably the largest passenger railroad. They run along the Northeast Corridor. They are all funded by federal funds. They have a special appropriation in the passenger reauthorization bill.
Senator Dunley?
Through the chair, and just clarify for me, if you do not receive the funds from the state to do this, how much could you, from your own current funding, dedicate towards this? What would be some numbers per year?
Senator, through the chair, the issue we face, and I'm going to try not to be really, really vague in this, so if I'm not answering the question, please let me know. But the issue we face is every dollar that we take and put towards PTC now, obviously, is a dollar that we cannot use on something else that we have. And we are, given the, again, sort of the things, the confluence of things coming together where our earnings are down, plus our federal monies have, dwindled to a shadow of what they were, our ability to put enough cash into the incredibly capital-intensive business that a railroad is really, it's not enough. We're generating, our capital budget for 2014 is, just a little above $20 million. We need to be putting somewhere closer to $40 to $50 million per year into the railroad just to maintain what we've got. This is not expansion capital. This is just keeping what I call the wheels on the wagon at this point. And, you know, going back a little bit, and again, make sure I come back to the give you the answer you need, but as Senator Meyer brought up, you know, we received the railroad, purchased the railroad in 1985, the state did. And it received a railroad that was just incredibly, with an incredible backlog of deferred maintenance. And it had been neglected under federal ownership. And so the railroad has struggled over the years to be able to upgrade and make put the money into the infrastructure that it needs to make it a safe and efficient transportation network. And so we were getting ahead of the curve a little bit with when the federal monies were coming in as strong as they were, when earmarks were out there and we were in these formula monies. All of that has, again, changed on us now. And as a result, the ability for us to put railroad cash in, I'm lying to you, it can be done, but it will be done at the expense of just keeping the existing infrastructure in good repair. Did that get to your question?
I guess, sort of. That's fine, thanks.
Okay. Well, I'd like to follow up on that. Is it possible to do a surcharge until we get this, you know, fully funded? Because obviously it's unfortunate that the feds kind of dumped this on you. I'm going to answer my own question here. I know it's a very competitive business with the trucking and the air, but still, I'm wondering if you couldn't do a surcharge until we get this fully funded.
Senator, we've actually, of course, looked at something like this. There's a number of issues with it, and not the least of which is the competitive issue, exactly as you say, but also the fact that a majority of our freight contracts and our the contracts we have on the passenger side. You know, I mean, of the, give or take, 490,000 passengers we moved in 2013, well over half, or certainly over half, were related to our cruise partners, coaches that we pull through contracts, agreements that we have in place with them, that, you know, not something we can just unilaterally go back and impose a some sort of charge on them. So it's we can't change the pricing, let's put it like that, for them.
You have a follow-up, Senator General? Go ahead.
Are you hauling passengers every day of the year?
Through the chair, no, we are not. We have year-round scheduled passenger service. Not surprisingly, the heaviest passenger moves are during the May 15th to September 15th time frame. But we do run a weekly train northbound to Fairbanks and southbound from Fairbanks. We also run a during the winter season or other than the summer season. We also run what we call a hurricane service, which takes people, and that's run on a monthly basis or more to throughout the year to get Alaskans to places that aren't served on the road system.
I guess I'm just doing some calculations here, and I'm just trying to figure out if it's worth just paying the fine. Well, it's $25,000 a day.
Per train. Every train?
Per train.
Per train.
Okay. That answers that.
And just to be clear, the whole concept, I only really got my attention when she started talking about it. It could also be levied against individuals.
Yeah. There you go. Senator Fairclough?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure that there were great reasons in 1985 to purchase the railroad. Have you went through a planning process to see if those reasons are still valid today, given that you've told us that the federal support is dropping and that your commercial business is dropping?
Senator, through the chair, and I admit I'm a little on the biased side on this, but yes. I mean, the railroad is a key piece of the transportation system for this state, and I think in a state that's really sort of shockingly devoid of infrastructure like this, the ability to have rail, you know, the passenger is very important, there's no doubt about that, but you know, freight to a large degree is what pays the bills for us, and it's just very important to the state.
Mr. Chairman, sure. If I might, but the real question is we're investing a dollar that benefits all Alaskans, and so if your freight business is declining, do we see a horizon where that's increasing or going to pick back up? Are people moving freight differently now? Are they on the roads and on the water instead of on the train?
Senator, through the chair, it's one of the things that we're really focusing on right now is growth and trying to kind of come out of this drop-off in freight. The vast majority of the freight drop-off has been related to two lines of business, and one being especially Flint Hills Resources owns the refinery up in Fairbanks, takes the oil out of taps, refines it, and moves it by rail down primarily to feed jet fuel needs at Anchorage International Airport. You know, that line of business has fallen markedly since the 2003 time frame. We're guardedly optimistic between the new royalty contract that this body approved, and it was last year, and hopefully some other changes in the marketplace that Flint Hills has stabilized and has the will have the opportunity to grow again. That said, one of our significant initiatives is to grow our revenue base, and I think to answer the question about the relevance, if it is, of the railroad, if it isn't already really evident, when a gas pipeline occurs here or any other significant development in the state, other than in probably the southeast area, the railroad will be a key component to making that happen.
Senator Frickle. Oh, I'm sorry.
I heard a voice a moment ago that also reminded me to talk a little bit about coal, and that's the second of the two freight lines that has shown a decline. Coal, and we run two kinds of coal. We run coal from the Healy, used by the mine at Healy, north to Fairbanks for the power plants up there, but we also run a significant portion of it south down to Seward for export to places like Chile, Korea, Japan, things like that. And the export market has softened markedly as the business cycle goes over the last year or two. And our coal movements southbound for export have really been cut in half from what they were in the 2011-2012 time frame. Again, we think this is, we're hopeful that this is something that is more of a temporary supply-demand issue on the world market, and there's still an awful lot of coal being burned out there. It's just that there's an awful lot of coal being supplied out there right now over Indonesia and Australia. Yeah, I mean, another voice just mentioned that it would be good for me to talk about our some of our other lines that have shown, business lines, freight lines that have shown, positive growth. And those are trailer on flat car service, our container on flat car service, and also the amount of our increased tonnage that we have seen of oil field supplies, where through our rail barge service, again, oil company can order pipe down in Houston, it can be railed up to our dock in Seattle, can be railed rolled right onto our rail barge, where it can sail up to Whittier, rolled off onto our system, and take up to Fairbanks, where it's then transloaded onto truck to support North Slope activity. So it's not all gloom and doom for the railroad. There are opportunities out there. It's just that it's very difficult to overcome in a short period of time the really rapid and significant drop-off related to petroleum and coal.
You need to build a line to Bethel. That's where the opportunity is, right, Senator Huffman?
Yeah, we're doing fine.
Okay, all right. Did you have a follow-up, Senator Fairclough?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is the Finance Committee. I want finance answers, and so if the legislature believes that investing money in the railroad is the right thing to do for Alaskans in general, and you've talked about different opportunities, do we have the right ownership model? Have you talked to or looked at that? How many states own railroads in our nation? If you could speak to that, and then I heard from Eileen that, you know, we have a group of large businesses with big pockets that have basically absconded with all of the technology and are, we're being funneled into paying possibly higher prices for things based on ownership interest. So should that big conglomerate buy the Alaska Railroad? I'm not even sure if they'd be interested, but do we have the right ownership model is really the question.
Certainly, through the chair. Senator, I believe we do, in that I think, you know, the my understanding of when the railroad was purchased by the state from the federal government, it was intended perhaps not to be owned by the state for the long term, but would be something that would be privatized in the future. And over the years, there have been different, I think, studies or even some interest shown by different groups about coming up and looking at purchasing the railroad. You know, from my perspective, I think that would be, you know, certainly, you know, be the executive and the legislative branch project to, you know, look at something like that. But I don't think that would work, just for the simple reason, given the density levels out there, given the importance of federal support for the railroad, which would not occur if it was privately owned. Also, the other piece of this is, in fact, when, along with the rail infrastructure that came over in 1985, 36,000 acres of land came with it. And, you know, the railroad has used that to help us, you know, buffer some of the business cycle changes out there. And I think there'd be significant question as to whether or not those land holdings that you know, came, that are part of the Alaska Railroad, would remain or would be sold with to that private entity, or would they go to under the purview of DNR? So, I think our enabling statute calls this, you know, an essential governmental function, and it. Given just the circumstances of Alaska and the circumstances of the economy, I believe, anyway, more personal opinion, that the railroad's ownership model is appropriate at this point.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Fairclough. You bring up a good point, Senator Fairclough, because there was a time where the telephone companies was a central part to the government, and as technology and times changed, we found out that it's better off having that in the private sector. And I know you do have a lot of land, and I'm sure you're maximizing the leasing of the land and the selling of the land to help pay for your operating costs and some of this capital. But, of course, that's information we don't know, which makes this a little difficult. But, Senator Kelly, you have a question?
Yeah, and you may have covered this in the presentation, and I just went over my head or something, but the rapid deployment and the cost of the monopoly on the technology, how much does that contribute to that $70 million? I mean, again, back of the napkin, short answer.
Well, the good news is, through the chair, I'm sorry, Senator Kelly, the FRA helped develop the radios, so they are setting the prices on the radios. So even though they're hard to come by because there's not enough manufacturing out there, they couldn't charge us more than what it costs to develop. So we're not paying extra for the radios. The manufacturers on the signal equipment, they aren't owned by the class ones, but they were told what the protocols for the communication they had to use, so they're setting their prices. Again, the problem is we're looking at 20-week lead time from the time we order something, from the time we receive it, and we only have, you know, certain times of the year to get it in. The price that most affects us cost-wise, and I can give you the cost, is we our radio spectrum that we need to use for the radios that were developed with the FRA funding and by the class ones was purchased before anybody knew that they had purchased this radio company. So we are now in negotiations trying to buy back the spectrum in Alaska because they bought it nationwide, which includes Alaska, and it's costing us somewhere, I'm allowed to say it when I'm in negotiations, but somewhere between $500,000 and $650,000. Now, if we got that spectrum ourselves, we might have been able to get it for quite a bit less but hard to say because the FCC is in the market to make money.
And well, that's not much of a delta on what we're talking about. With
yes, I agree.
So let me just try to figure it out. So we currently have a bill for $70 million,
mm-hmm.
and a portion of that, $70 million, is the result of the time frame involved and this proprietary equipment that you have to buy, and the fact that that cost has gone up. If we were to develop the, hang with me, this may sound crazy, wouldn't be the first time, if we were to develop this ourselves, how much money could we save, or is that even possible? And what I'm thinking of, the University of Alaska has actual rocket science scientists that work for them. Maybe we have a resource to develop this on our own, and we've not looked at that. And if you were to say, okay, we got $70 million and $20 million is based on the nonsense factor that we're dealing with this, can we take $20 million and say Alaskans can develop this system? Or is it possible?
We tried.
Ah.
Our last project, we were moving along pretty nicely. We were out there testing trains, stopping trains, making sure they didn't go past their authority, that ice didn't affect us, right? We had the office systems in place. And then the Rail Safety Improvement Act came about and added two functions that are very expensive, and that's our real delta. One is adding this wayside monitoring equipment and work zone protection.
Okay, so those two... how much of those costs are just unavoidable no matter what you do?
You know, our problem, where most of our money goes on wayside, is developing the power to run the radios and the equipment to say whether the switch is in the normal position. So I don't know that any is unavoidable. There have been a few companies that have tried to develop low-cost switch monitoring equipment. But the rail industry, 99.9999% proof of vitality is hard to overcome by a small company. If you haven't been in the rail industry, it's in short order getting there to prove that what they call system is vital, the switch monitoring, hasn't been done yet by anybody other than the already known manufacturers. So I'm not sure any of it's avoidable.
Yeah.
Other than had the law not changed, we would have been in a lot better shape.
Okay, did you want to finish your presentation before we, or are you done?
I think we're the end is near here. Just before we actually head into the final slide, and on this only comment I'd like to make, Senator, actually to your Senator Meyer, your actual comment about, you know, the legislature doesn't know about certain of these things, and I mean I understand that, but I just certainly want to let this committee know. And you know, normally we do an overview to the Finance Committee a little more about how the railroad's business is doing and things of that nature. This opportunity this year, given our request out here, but we're certainly open to you know, any kind of briefing or any kind of information that you need. Obviously, we have some competitive or proprietary type numbers that you know we have to be careful about in a public forum. But I just want to make sure that the committee is aware of this, that willing to talk to you about anything that you may have regarding our finances, our books, how we handle those kind of things. So I just wanted to say that before kind of heading into the finish here. You know, positive train control is not just a big deal for the Alaska Railroad, but it's probably the biggest deal going on right now for all, you know, of the major railroads and all the passenger railroads in the country. And, you know, as you probably have seen from this particular briefing, we're extremely fortunate to have Eileen with us. Eileen's really known as one of the foremost experts on this positive train control in the nation, and is looked to by not only our peer railroads, but also by the regulators as a, you know, very valuable resource. So we're very fortunate to have her here. You know, we are trying to move forward with this expensive project, and we do need your help. And hopefully today we've given you an opportunity to understand the project a little bit better, and also understand some of the situation that brings us to coming to the legislature for help. So I don't know if I've got a whole lot more to finish with other than, you know, again, we have $15 million in the governor's budget right now. Our request is for the $40.8 million used. We think it's a prudent decision for the legislature, and we hope you see the same way. If there's any other questions, we do produce on a quarterly basis a report that I think has either been provided to you or is certainly we can get to you. I believe we send it out to all legislators. Our quarterly report on the project and lets you know exactly where it's at, both from a funding perspective and also from an actual project delivery perspective. So okay. We appreciate the time today, and thank you.
You're not done.
Okay.
We do have some questions. I just wanted to make sure you had a chance to finish your PowerPoint. And we will need to adjourn here probably the next 5 or 10 minutes. But Senator Fairclough, I believe you had some additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You and I serve locally, and I believe you served on AMATS as well during the course of your service there. And so this is a proposal for a financial solution. So if we agree that we have the right ownership model and that continuing to invest in the railroad is the right way to go, cash flow becomes an issue for the state of Alaska right now. And you're asking for 2 years because cash flow is an issue for you in competitively purchasing. And so at least from when we served on AMATS, Mr. Chairman, there was an ability based on a revenue stream coming in from the federal government to actually do a revenue bond and commit your future revenues that are actually coming from the federal government. The reason I suggest this as a potential to explore to do the entire $70 million versus 41 that you're asking for or anything else is that this is an unfunded federal mandate. But I'm not sure where you're investing your federal dollars now and whether you get capital dollars associated with those or is your federal revenue stream that you said we wouldn't receive if we privatized the railroad, is that in operating expense or do they give you capital? The market is prime for a bond at the low rate right now that we're receiving. So if we tied the federal revenue stream, and I can't recall the name of the bond.
Garvey.
What is it?
Garvey.
The Garvey bonds, thank you very much. Yes, it is. Would that be something that would work for this capital expenditure?
Through the chair, Senator, there was a possibility of it, but we kind of we've already done that, is what occurred. In 2006 and 2007, we leveraged our federal monies, our FTA formula funds, to issue $165 million worth of bonds. The legislature approved that bond issue or that approach to accelerate our track rehabilitation program to be able to do what would have taken us, you know, 12 to 15 years, do it basically in 7, and therefore derive the safety benefits that much quicker and the efficiency benefits of a safer, more efficient network out there. We receive right now, give or take, somewhere around $28 million of federal money, of FTA monies per year. And $17 million of that comes right off the top and goes to pay the debt service for those bonds, those essentially Garvey bonds currently. The issue with, so we do have some monies left out of that, which we use for capital activities. We plow into the existing or to projects, rail ties, ballast bridges, things of that nature on the federal money. The other issue with that is one of the things we didn't talk about was the fight that the railroad has right now to retain our FTA monies. We are, for lack of a better term, really under attack by certain members of Congress who don't believe we look like the kind of entity that should be receiving these particular types of funds. And as a result of that, I think it would be extremely difficult. We think we're going to have another battle when the next transportation reauthorization comes up. My belief is that we would not be successful in trying to leverage future funds of that nature, given the uncertainty that's out there on our FTA monies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and if I could just follow up on that a little bit. Hopefully you are working with our federal delegation back in D.C. because you mentioned to me that implementing this PTC is going to cost us $5 or $6 million additional dollars every year in operating costs, which you don't have. And so hopefully we get some help at the federal level for that. And I guess my final question is, you said that they're still writing the rules for this PTC program, and that scares me because we're starting to spend money, starting to plan. And if the rules change, then, you know, is there a risk that you're too far ahead of the cart here? And we go ahead.
Through the chair, very good question. The regulations were complete in 2010, and there was a lawsuit on certain functions of the rule, of the regulations, and those are being settled right now by the Class 1 railroads. We know what the notice of proposed rulemaking is, so we're not at any risk. The one area, though, that is new, it says protection of work zone incursions as one of the requirements. There's different ways that you can take that mission on, and with the October highest fatality rate for maintenance way workers out there, the FRA is being adamant that their suggested implementation strategy be used, not the railroads, where you have a verbal conversation and you press a button and say it's clear to go. They want some kind of technology. So we know what the issues are, and we are staying on top of them, but we're not at risk that we have to go back and redo. It's risk that we have to add some kind of handheld application for our maintenance way workers.
Okay. Well, very good. I do appreciate you coming here today, and this presentation has been very insightful, and we learned, I think, a little bit more about the frustrations that the railroad has and is going through.
One last comment.
Yes, Senator Kelly. Sure.
You know, you guys probably get from us a level of anger about this, and it's certainly not directed at you guys. You do a great job. I love the railroad. We're as frustrated as you are. We're more frustrated than you because I think you have more information than us. So please keep that in mind, okay? Nice job.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you both. And so we're going to go ahead and adjourn here for tomorrow. I believe this was set up by you, Senator Kelly, Mike McKinnon with the Rural Transportation Infrastructure Development.
Which bill?
You should use your mic. But anyway, so we're adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow.